and raining steadily. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, Roberta Maria Atti, a wonderful person, beautiful spirit. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Atti.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Back with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Bringing you this 10th in a very exciting series of programs on human sexuality. We've been talking about evolutionary psychology, and today is a very important part because it brings a good piece of this to a close. The basis of understanding our biological roots of human evolution is very important, and many people disagree with the whole concept of evolutionary psychology. Many people say monkeys are monkeys and humans are humans, and never the twain shall meet. Other people, like Darwinists, took the idea of survival of the fittest and used it as part of a way of destroying humankind, like the Nazis and the way they used social Darwinism. So there are a lot of reasons why, and then there are people who say, if you say that that animals and humans are connected sexually and that our sexual behaviors come from our animal ancestry, then you're putting women down. And that there is no difference between men and women, really. So all of these are issues that I fully embrace and fully appreciate, but we are going to continue along with what we believe.
Armand, I'd like to present an image worthy of some thought, and that is the statue of Eros and Psyche, love and mind. And it's the epitome, of course, of erotic and romantic love. I'm sure a lot of people have seen some statue or painting or something artistic representative of erotic love. If you imagine that between a man and a woman, and then you imagine the same scene between two monkeys, there is an obvious difference that cannot be ignored. One is inspiring of a certain set of feelings that the other one does not. And I just wanted to say that obviously there's something about human sexuality that is not just biological.
And if it is human sexuality we're talking about human evolution in general. 144,000 years ago, we ran into a conundrum. This we know for sure. Briefly stated, Roberta?
The conundrum was that because of humans' propensity to thinking, the brains of human beings were becoming too large, and women were having difficulties giving birth. And so women were faced with the challenge of figuring out how to survive this life experience, giving birth. And because of that, I guess they had to give it some thought, to give some thought to what would cause pregnancy. And so they kind of took control of sexuality and its rhythm. And so what we have done in this series is drawn a map of how sexuality has been the thread that has interwoven the texture of human society and the culture and the evolution of human interactions and exchange.
What we want to present you with today is how there are threads of that conundrum, or parts of that struggle that still stay with us. Like, where do we have such strong biological impulses if they can't be acted out at any time? We're going to present to you today a lot of the difficulties that humans currently, at this point in evolution, face. And we're going to propose something as to how we can work with this as efficiently as possible. Remember that to understand ourselves is ultimately the highest form of love. To understand ourselves means that we can look at ourselves and not be blaming the rest of the world. We can see what part we play in everything. To understand other people means not to judge them. Understanding is love. Judgment is hate. So most suffering has been based on love, sex, sensuality, and issues around that.
Yes, Armand, it seems that the human drama, the reason why a lot of people get to the most difficult emotional challenges is an issue that revolves around what to do with their sexuality, what is right and what is good. See, there's a difference between good and right, and very often those two things are in antagonism, are in conflict. What feels good may not be what is right, and vice versa. So a lot of the drama that people experience day in and day out has to do with making choices based on, should I select what is good or should I select what is right?
Much of life's threats and the ugliness of life is usually around money, sex, and power. And money, sex, and power seem to in some way go around the issue of who's going to be in charge. And who is it that wants to be in charge? Well, you know, the alpha male in the gorilla pack it wants to be in charge because he wants to have as much as he wants, whenever he wants it, wherever he wants it. And his job in life is to have totally available sex whenever he wants it. And for this, he's willing to fight to the death.
But see, there's a certain simplicity in that, and human sexuality is so complex. You know, there are so many question marks that come up when we explore sexuality. I mean, even the amount of emails that we got every time we've done a program on this series has been remarkable, that people feel strongly about certain things and they respond, and it's been fascinating to read these responses. But human sexuality really, Armand, seems to be the reason why certain laws and rules and regulations have been established, and in a way, traditional knowledge, traditional beliefs, all of that, if you look at it, is based on what protects the family, what protects the sexuality, the human sexuality, what protects it from its own implicit dangers.
Armand Emil here, Roberta Aki. We're going to start with some of the classical duality that we all feel, or many people feel, those things that happen. I mean, here you have inherited a genetic structure that dictates survival of the species, procreation, right, and being able to just survive in general.
And so there is one part of survival of the species, for instance, that says mate with as many women as you can, and then there is another part that says that's not a good thing to do.
Well, the part that we inherit is the part that comes from the past that says randomly spill those seeds, and in fact, female as well. You know, have many partners, collect many sperm. Or as men will spread your sperm around and try to get them out there. There's a primitive thing that says you're going to have this impulse, and this impulse is going to guide you.
Be fruitful and multiply.
Exactly. Let's look at some of the conflicts that we have, and then later, as we've gotten to where we are today, we say, wait a minute, that's not such a good idea. For example, having babies, not having babies. If there is one thing that motivates almost every species on the planet, it's reproduction. More than actual survival. If a plant is dying, with its dying breath, it will put out a flower to attract some bee to pick up its pollen to take it on to somewhere else, more than it will put itself out there to get water or food. Reproduction becomes the primary goal of many living things. So if the first goal in life, or the highest motive of life, is for a being to reproduce, and this is what you all feel, if you gotta have babies, and some part of you says, I gotta have babies, then what happens? Later somewhere, as a human in today's society, you look around you and you say, yeah, you know, I can't afford babies. If I have a baby, I won't be able to bring it up. If I have a baby, I won't be able to travel. If I have a baby, there'll be nobody to take care of it. If I have a baby, I'll be adding to the world's supplies of babies, and there are too many already. So now here you are, forced into this kind of situation. Your body says, have a baby. Your mind says, not so sure. Your body says, have a baby with just about anybody. Your mind says, no, I've learned choosing the right partner helps me. This is what's happened in evolution. You all have sat with that situation, with that duality, with that conundrum. Let's talk about some of the other ones. Ideas like monogamy versus polygamy. Well, in nature, mostly, animals are not monogamous.
With humans, it seems that the more sedentary a culture is, the more monogamous it tends to be, or the more monogamous laws it tends to uphold, and the more nomadic a population is, the more polygamous it tends to be. So again, what we see there reflected in what is believed to be the right thing is a biological need. Because if you stay somewhere all your life, it's not ideal to have polygamy, because it possibly creates conflict within your within the space that you inhabit.
It could create genetic inbreeding.
Genetic inbreeding. So it's not a good idea. However, if you are a nomad, if you move from place to place to place to place, then it makes a lot of sense, yes, to have many different mates.
A traveling salesman are more at risk than the guy who works in a single office.
I guess, according to that theory, yes. But see, when we look at biology, really, we do find a lot of answers as to why sexuality has developed the way it has.
And that we sit with the conflict. So let's say you are a traveling salesman, and you've got a wandering eye, and you're now traveling, and something inside you says, do it here, nobody's going to find out. You know, leave it in Las Vegas. So now another part of your mind comes in and says, no, wait a minute, I've got this commitment. And now this thinking takes place. And you say to yourself, maybe yes, maybe no. How do we deal with these conflicts? Let's talk about more of them. Jealousy.
That's a big one. Well, it's a big one because it's innate, meaning it's very normal for both male and female to be jealous. There is a direct threat to a person's, to an individual's survival when one's mate is, floundering? So it's a very strong innate need to feel secure that one's mate is not going to abandon oneself because he or she falls in love with someone else. And yet, there is also this other part that that says, well, so what if this person feels like being affectionate with someone else? Why should I feel so threatened by that? It doesn't make sense.
The level of threat that a person feels inexperienced, the level of upset that you could feel over your mate getting up close to somebody else who looks attractive, who may take your mate away, the level of upset, that jealousy, is not only your mind and the weakness of your mind and your inadequacy.
Oh, no.
It is very primal.
It's mostly your body, in fact.
It's mostly some part of your body saying, I'm going to rip your heart out if you go with somebody else.
Because there's a direct threat to the survival.
Of not only yourself, but the entire species.
Yes, but I think this comes really, I mean, jealousy is very individual. I think the jealousy is a direct threat to my survival. And yes, it's absolutely in the body. Jealousy awakens the adrenals, the glands on top of the kidneys that are the ones in charge of dealing with stress. And for this reason, jealousy is also a great aphrodisiac, Armand. Jealousy is used as a way to...
Now we're talking about some of the advantages of the very conflicts.
Well, yes, because of course when a person is jealous, his or her interest in his or her mate is increased, is enhanced. And the competition itself is a great spur for, improving one's look, improving one's gifts. In other words, if I am afraid that my mate is going to engage with someone else, then I'm going to make sure that I give my best when I am with this person because I want to be the best. So in a way, jealousy is one of those biological imperatives that has contributed in a way to the evolution of the species.
It's a funny thing that jealousy itself can lead to love, because you could build up such a passion out of your jealousy that you could get so involved in it, so incredibly involved in it, that you could feel so connected to the other being because of what's called the cathexis. You are now, you're focused on them. You may not in a million years think that anybody, you know, if you had a mate and you were totally sure of your mate and you never thought your mate would go off with anybody else, you would feel a very different sexual energy than if your mate is looking good and somebody's sidling up to him or her.
Right. And so that jealousy can be a killer, Armand, jealousy can be a killer of love because when it gets out of hand, it is so destructive and it is such a powerful blind force. In a human relationship between lovers, it is so blind. You know, look at Othello. I mean, just one sentence, one suggestion by someone external to the relationship is enough to cause such a blind rage in some people that they would kill, that they would destroy the very object of love that they are trying to protect, that they are trying to salvage. And it's interesting also that for some people, jealousy is not only not an aphrodisiac, but it's the opposite. In other words, if a person knows that his or her mate has been with someone else, love dies and is never to be found again.
For many people.
It cannot be revived.
And for others, they will send their mate out. Others will say to their mate, go out and have sex with somebody out and come back and tell me about it, and that's what turns me on. Emil Buss, B-U-S-S, wrote a book called The Dangerous Passion. And in it, he deals with jealousy. And he proposed that the basis of murder, human murder, which is not in our animals. You know, murder is a funny kind of thing. Animals kill each other, but they kill each other for a reason. He says the basis of human murder is jealousy.
Hmm.
That the fact that we have developed a thing called murder, premeditated, I'm going to go out and get that guy because of jealousy.
Right.
And he said it's at the basis of jealousy. Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atti. We're talking about some of the evolutionary psychology and some of the biological conundrums that we sit with, biological and thought conundrums.
But the thing, Armand, that I think we need to say is since biologically we're so similar to animals, which is what we've been saying all along, that the brain of humans really has evolved following the needs of survival, which is what animals have done, then why is it that human sexuality is so different, is so complex, is so, evocative of doubts and questions and dilemmas, and it questions the very core of the self, because I think that a lot of people define themselves based on how they perceive themselves to be in relation to a mate or in relation to a potential mate. A lot of people define themselves based on their capacity to attract a mate or to maintain a relationship. When people lose a mate and, they don't have a high level of self-esteem, often they can get into a grief that is so big that it can kill them. So human sexuality seems to be one of the most powerful biological drives, as well as one of the most transcendental experiences that one can engage into.
You know, if you look at the difference, if you say to yourself, what part of human sexuality confuses me the most? Well, let's put it this way. If you're a man, and if your leaning is towards having partners of the opposite sex, you say to yourself, I don't understand women. I don't understand them. I really don't make it. In your mind, you make up that you understand it. You could read John Gray. I was going to say Earl Gray.
Earl Gray.
That's very good. And you read John Gray, and you could say men are from Venus and Mars and all that stuff, and you could say that's the difference. Women like this and men like this. We were reading a recent article on the difference between the sexes, but the confusion that you get as a woman trying to understand men, what do you say to yourself? All men are pigs. All they want to do is have sex. No, this is not true. But there is a very strong biological urge that surges through maleness, and it has many parts to it. Many, many parts to it, not just basic, you know, it's going to be just basic hormones coming out. We did a series of programs on male sexuality, which went into this in depth, 10 different programs called About Men, because there was such a demand from both men to try to understand their own sexuality and from women to understand the sexuality of men.
Armand, I'm thinking as I'm listening to you speak, and I don't know why I never thought of this before, but look at the Judeo-Christian tradition. The whole business of losing the Garden of Eden, the right to be there, starts from sexuality.
Sure it does.
Right? And it starts from humans' awareness of being naked, and humans' awareness that there's something about being naked and sexual that could disobey the very thing that creates the whole thing. Therefore, could disobey God, which means, think about it, Armand, if I can disobey, right, the divinity, then that means I am a co-creator of reality, because that means I can decide, I have the free will to decide not to do what I have been designed to do, but to take off in my own direction, to make my own decision of what I'm going to evolve into. Isn't that amazing?
You know, nakedness got lost.
What do you mean?
By staring at the snake, by listening to the snake. You know, there's a whole symbolism of the Garden of Eden.
Sure, of course.
Right, Adam and Eve are walking around, they're nice and and then she pays attention to the guy's snake, and she says, ooh.
Armand.
The snake, and then he says, let me eat your
apple.
But
the snake was the devil, supposedly.
Yeah, well, but the symbolism is a little too interesting.
I understand what you're saying.
Nakedness disappeared. Then that was the end of nakedness. Then being naked and
But innocent. That was the beginning of nakedness. Because up until that point, Adam and Eve had been naked, but they didn't know it.
Right, so nakedness is the consciousness of not having clothing.
Right, and so it begins with...
No animal in nature, Roberta, none is aware of being naked.
Exactly. So in theory, they're still in the Garden of Eden, but we have lost the right to be there. You know why? Because we said to God, look, I'm going to do my own thing, which means that I am going to know that I'm naked, and I am going to know that what I am showing is a part of me that is so powerful that it can threaten even you.
Well, whether you think we said it to God, or we take a look, and we took a look 144,000 years ago and said to Mother Nature, we can't do it your way, because to do it your way is not going to help us survive. So whether 144,000 years ago they turned around and said, you know what we're going to have to do? We're going to have to do something creative here. We're going to have to think.
That's it. That's it. Creativity. And that's exactly what I'm saying, that by establishing sexuality in this way, the human has really taken a step of disobedience towards the biological imperatives that had controlled evolution up until that point. So from that moment on, the human has truly become the king and queen of his and her own destiny, biologically and evolutionarily speaking. So this is, sexuality is the key, is the beginning of disobedience, and it's also the key to co-creation and freedom to be the gods and goddesses that we are.
An interesting thing, Roberta. Well said, by the way.
Thank you.
Imagine if 144,000 years ago, Sister Jane and Sister Anna didn't get together and say, you know, we got to do something about it. Everybody's dying because the babies are coming in too early. You're 13 years old. You don't have a pelvis big enough for this big noggin that we're developing in humans. Would the species have died off, or would it have adapted? And how would we look today if thinking never came around?
Wow.
What would we have looked like? We would have had to shrink our heads again. We'd have had to, like, little pinheads. Right, to go through,
yeah.
Right? We would have, our whole biology would have changed.
That's right. If we
women would have gotten bigger pelvises and heads would have gotten smaller.
If we had followed the dictates of biology, we certainly would not have evolved into the species that can send a rocket to the moon. It would have been impossible. The way in which we got to the point where we can think the way we do, where we have the technology that we have, is because we were disobedient. Disobedient, one can say to God, one can say to Mother Nature, disobedient to biology, disobedient to evolution. We took control of it. It's the anthroposphere, you know, Armand. We have the biosphere, the atmosphere, the hydrosphere. We have all these spheres of creation that have created the planet the way it is. Well, the anthroposphere, which means the human sphere, is as much a co-creator of Earth as all the other spheres.
So we have to live with these conflicts, my friend, and we all do. Sure, you get jealous. Sure, you turn around and you say to yourself, I can't be jealous. I cannot afford to be involved in this jealousy. I have to be permissive. I cannot restrict my man or my woman so much that they never look at or touch anybody else. I have to maybe trust their word, but I can't follow them around because it'll make me crazy. Something goes on in your mind. You go from raging jealousy to permissiveness. You go from wanting babies to deciding to have no babies. You go from the idea of monogamy or polygamy to monogamous choices. Look at the kind of problems that you've lived with. My friends, there are ways that you say to yourself, I must control myself, and you sit day in and day out sitting with these conflicts. You look at a good-looking guy or gal or an intelligent person that you're attracted to, and you have stirrings. How do you handle that? Well, we're going to show you something about that today that is quite remarkable, the duality, the conflict, the conundrum that you sit with every day between your sexuality and your knowledge. This is Armand DeMille with you with Roberta Atti. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back with you after a little cute music.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Okay, here we go, Armand.
Too sexy for my love, love's going to leave.
With you with the positive mind. I'm too sexy for my shirt. Right, said Fred. So, WBAI 99.5 FM, Roberta Achi and I have been exploring with you over the series of 9 weeks previous to this one. This is our 10th. Human sexuality, human evolution, human, what it does to us, how we get through it. It is amazing. It is amazing. Let's talk about some of the conflicts. Roberta, let's do the male-female difference. As according to what we have in science, what is the difference between men and women according to what has been studied and, of course, to the great objections of many people who say there is no difference?
You mean what is the difference in the sexualities and
yes,
in the...
Yes, and the conflicts that they deal with.
Okay, well, for instance, let's talk about short-term affairs. Short-term relationships. Well, unfortunately, Armand, it has been confirmed, it seems like, from research, that when men are looking to have, let's say, a one-night stand, intelligence is not preferred. It seems that actually lower than average intelligence is the preferred quality
by both women and men when it comes to short-term affairs.
Only by men.
Women
always prefer more intelligence.
I don't believe it.
Yes, that is what.
I don't believe what it says.
That
here
is
either.
According to Daniel Dennoon on WebMD, and it was reviewed by Michael Smith, Dr. Michael Smith. It says that men have a preference for lower than average intelligence when it comes to short-term relationships or to just one-night stand or affairs.
I mean, if a woman is walking down the street and she sees a sexy guy who's too sexy for his shirt, and he just looks hot and sexy and he's a stripper at a bar, she's not going to be just as attracted for the short-term one-nighter as the man would be to the short-term one-nighter?
No.
I don't think women want intelligence only.
Looks is not the primary factor in a woman's choice. Primary factor is assertiveness, the sense of power, the sense of status, the sense of, you know, for a man to be in charge of himself, or, you know, to give a sense of being competent and powerful, basically.
Okay, so we have two things.
But remember, for men, looks, and we've said this throughout the series, looks is a very, very powerful trigger because of the way that the man's brain is wired. I mean, to some extent, because man is the hunter, and because of the way that the eyes of the man has been wired to follow and seek prey.
The jiggle.
The jiggle, exactly. We talked about the jiggle, which is what fat does when it moves. Same thing gets activated when the man is on the hunt for a mate. It's really in the brain, the pathways are so close, they're so closely connected that for a man it's very difficult to separate the two. And so to a great extent, the looks of a woman is the first thing that a man is attracted to, not so for women, because women look for get excited about different things.
Our tendency when talking in evolutionary psychology is to talk in terms of heterosexuality. So we are doing that when we refer to these things, but I think it has to be extrapolated to same sexuality as well. You know, and you'll see it. Now take a look at this. We are saying there are short-term relationships and long-term relationships, and men and women are different in their search for short-term versus long-term. According to one theory, Michael Smith, Daniel Dennun, a number of other people say, yes, men want less complicated, more attractive.
More playful.
Now, and what could that be about? That could mean availability. It could be playfulness. It could be that a man wants to have his sexuality like a child, like he wants to have the youthful childishness or adolescence
of a
rampant sexuality, and he can't do that with somebody who is thinking too much and figuring things out too much and too much in her mind. So what he chooses is somebody who will be playfully permissive.
If you look at adult movies, Armand, I don't know what else to call them. What's the way to describe adult movies?
Any technical words?
Yeah.
Dirty movies.
Okay. what you see is basically the fantasies of men. I mean, most of those movies are made by men for men, and so the fantasies contained in there are mostly fantasies that appeal to men, also because men are the consumers of these products. What you see in these movies is the fantasy of what ideally a man wants when he's looking for, you know, to have fun. And what you see is these women who are completely uninterested in anything else but sex. They are sexy in the way they look. They are sexy in the way they move. They only think about sex. Look for sex. They don't want anything else but sex. Okay, so this is the fantasy. And in these movies, the fantasy is created in the perfect way that it
now
is imagined.
And what's perfect about that, Roberta, what's really perfect about that is because if we go back to our ancestors, it is the before humans. It was the Estrusian. It is the woman in estrus, the female in estrus that the male was hunting for.
Right.
What we are saying is porn movies show women in estrus.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
And it's like...
They don't show the children that come out of the women
estrus. It's just women in estrus.
Then it becomes diapers and it becomes sleepless night. It becomes all of that.
But estrus meaning I want to have sex. Is that right? I mean, that's the female.
I'm ready, right.
I am ready to have sex, and I want to have sex.
I'm fertile.
I'm fertile, and I want as much of it as I could find from the most powerful guy around.
Right. Now,
this, I think, is found phenomenal. Because now we think of ourselves as humans. A porn industry developed out of the creation or the shift from an animal nature of having sex triggered by the presence of estrus. The female is ready, the male responds. Then they become humans. And when you become a human, the female no more tells you when she's ready.
But,
for survival, she had to hide her readiness so that she could choose her partners.
Those women portrayed in those movies are not real women, in the sense that very few women really behave like that. And very few women are really interested in that kind of sex, or maybe they might be interested in it occasionally when they're young and single, but it's not the kind of sexual life that a woman would choose to have all the time.
What I'm saying is important about this, Roberta, has nothing to do with women. It has to do with the male remnants of being thrown back in time so far. He goes so far back, and it's all over him all the time. And he looks at this, and he says to himself, how could I feel this way? And how do I feel this way? I have these impulses. I have these desires. I get these porn movies. I'm addicted to it. I look at it, and once I get involved in it, I can't stop. I got to watch movie after movie, and I've got to see this, and I'm going to touch myself, and I'm going to bring myself to orgasm, and I'm going to look at it on the internet, and this drive, this kind of addiction happens. But I think addiction happens when it brings you back to your primal needs, all the way back in time. So now, here's a man who's a classically nice businessman, lives with his family, taking care. He could be a musician. He doesn't have to be a businessman. But he's taking care of things. He's everything. And suddenly, this stuff becomes available, and he sees it, and he gets turned on to it. Now, here's this conflict. I'm attracted to this, and I don't know. It's dirty. I'm told it's evil. It's demeaning, and I feel compulsive about it. On the other hand, I love my wife. I want to be with her. I want to be only with her. I don't think I should be with anyone else. What does man do with that state of being? What does he do with that? Women can have similar things. They could feel the difficulty of being at home and being a housewife and being treated like they're no longer even female. They're just a house mother. And some guy comes along and he's suddenly attractive to them or intelligent or has a discussion with them or shows some depth. And she begins to fantasize about him. What happens? Well, the way we've been seeing it, that in all of these dualities, something valuable happens. Not just that we can take and impose morality on it, which is one of the ways that we keep ourselves down, but that in all of these things, something positive happens. For example, the need to dominate. Every animal wants to dominate its environment. But then it looks around and it says, I can't control everything. So the mind says, submit. Give in. So now you have this, again, tension. I want to dominate. I want to control. The other side, I want to let it go. Most people sit and they torture their minds with this. I want, but I've got to. I want, but I've got to. I want, but I've got to. And then, introduced into this, is where I want to ask you to pick this up, Roberta, into this mix of conflict, we look for a way to solve it, and we introduce morality.
Well, morality is the way in which it's the way in which we maintain a sense of safety, I would say, because when it comes to sexuality, permissiveness can be experienced as threatening to the survival of the individual, because it threatens the primary relationships, it threatens the belief system. So the body generates morality in order to protect itself, to protect its own self-preservation interests. The body also, at the same moment as it generates morality, it also exposes its desire to reproduce, because the body of humans, as we were saying in the beginning of the program, Armand, is very sexy. It is a body that is naked. It is a body that is aware of being naked. So morality is one end of the spectrum, and permissiveness or disobedience, let's say, is the other end of the spectrum. Now, what is created out of the tension is the third dimension. It's the possibility of creativity, meaning that out of the tension of what to do, out of the tension of having to make a choice, because whether we choose to support morality or whether we choose to not support morality, we are making a choice. That is where we become creative with ourselves. Now, if we go towards morality, we may end up depressed or feeling empty or feeling dissatisfied with life. There's no spice to it. There's no excitement. We kind of become logged with inertia. If we go to the side of disobedience and permissiveness, we may end up in deep, deep guilt and shame because we're doing something that morality says we should not be doing. So either sides, whether we stick with morality or whether we go to permissiveness, there is a loss of tension. And now, that, I think, is where we get in trouble.
So our presentation to you, to my friends, we've looked at this over 10 different weeks. By the way, these programs, the 9 previous programs, are available to you by calling 212-757-4488. 757-4488. If what we've come to is the importance of this tension. I want to speak to Roberta Maria Atti about the importance of tension in the human body. How does a heart function without tension, Roberta?
Oh, it can't, of course.
It needs tension. How does blood pump without tension?
Everything in the human body needs tension in order to function. And in the mind as well, Armand.
I was looking at what happens when a person has cardiac arrest and they go into fibrillation. It is primarily the tension that is keeping our blood pumping.
Sure, when there's
when
a collapse.
When you block it, right. And there's a collapse, it doesn't know what to do. It just fibrillates.
Right.
It just gets...
Right, and that's exactly what we're saying at the end of this series, that the tension created by the way we handle sexuality has been one of the major creative forces in human evolution.
Sexual tension is not a bad thing. You can get rid of it, of course, and a lot of people do that. You know, they say, oh, we won't have any of that in this church. You know,
and that's siding with morality, and there's a collapse of tension there, but there's also a collapse of tension if we become addicted to sex and we perennially engage in indiscriminate sex. So either side is a collapse.
Well, neither one necessarily, none of the three could be wrong.
Oh, no, I'm not
okay,
saying they're wrong. They're all
if a person chooses to cover every inch of their body and to hide their face and to never allow their sexuality to come out, and if somebody decides to join the priesthood, and we know how that could successfully help suppress all of your sexuality, if you join some religious order or some culture where it's all pushed down, that's one option. Then you push it down and you free yourself on many levels to have a spiritual, intellectual focus. On the other hand, you could join a different culture, like back in the 60s.
Flower power?
Flower power, where you say, we're not going to limit anything. Let's do everything we want to whoever we want, whenever we want, as many times as we want. And in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, that worked too. That was phenomenal. It didn't develop any great amount of industry, but it was a fun thing for people to do. But they tried that also. It seems that somewhere in the middle of that is maintaining this point of evolution. Here we are, my friends. We're trying to grow to the next step. So we are feeling this enormous kind of sexual tension with a consciousness that is saying, no, you can't act it out, because if you act it out, then it kind of blows it out of the water for you. You don't get what you want. But instead of one repressing the other, instead of one canceling the other, instead of the person with the sexual urges having to go out there and randomly have sex with whoever he could hire, or instead of the person who is suppressing themselves to close down everything and wear a chastity belt, instead of the two, we believe that if you keep both options open in your mind, if you look at your mind and you say to yourself, I am both. I'm a highly sexual being, and I'm a person of choice. And I don't do it out of guilt. I don't hold myself back out of guilt. I hold myself back out of choice. And I will hold myself back if I believe I should, and I may step off occasionally, but I am going to hold both tensions, my awareness of my impulses and my desire to maintain another level of consciousness. How do you hold both? Well, that's what maximum health is in the human body, having both the urges and the bounces.
And even when we look at the body and the state of health, you know, as described by the person themselves, I find that people describe themselves at the worst when they perceive that they are being too strict with themselves and not allowing anything that they desire to be experienced because of this self-imposed morality. Or people can be totally collapsed into guilt and shame, and you know, they walk around beating themselves on the head, declaring their guilt and worthlessness, and both sides are quite uncomfortable. Now, from the middle of the road, which is what Armand is describing, the place where at least we understand why we're so sexually awake, why we're so sexually expressive as a species, why we're so sexually artistic, because all of the arts, I mean, most of the arts are revolve around sexuality, poetry, music. I mean, do you think Beethoven did not include his sexuality in his symphonies? Just listen to them. Just listen to Symphony Number 3 or 5. You will almost be aroused by this music because there is so much sexuality. And here is a man who is losing his hearing and who is desperate, who is certainly unhappy. But sexuality is definitely part of all of the masterpieces of art and philosophy. So that place that Armand is describing, the middle of the road, is really the source of the most exquisite creativity that humans have been endowed with.
And that's what steps us to our next place as beings, my friend. Imagine an alert, conscious, in control, but not controlled being who has the joy of knowing that they feel alive, physically, sexually, intellectually, and have control over their lives without it having to be repressive. This is, I think, where we go next, and this is what I think leads us to our next level of development, which will be coming, where the conflicts will not be as strong, and they will not be as difficult for us, but it's where the next human is going to come from, the next one that's going to step up. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We are here with you, WBAI 99.5 FM, It has been a remarkable series which of 10 programs about human sexuality that I've heard have been somewhere around the world by now. I've gotten letters from London. I know we have a listener in London right now who said that they were listening to this program because they got access to them or they were sent over. Christmas time is over, is coming up. Might not be a bad thing for somebody you love. This is Armand DeMille with you. If you wanted to contact Roberta, you would call, you would send her an email at roberta4health. Roberta4health.
The number 4 at AOL.com.
Are you doing any lectures this weekend?
I am actually doing a workshop on December 11th. December 11th at Sufi Books, but I am going to do a program at the Open Center in January, so if anybody is interested, that's
where the Open Center.
The Open Center, the New York Open Center, yes.
And if you wanted a copy of today's program or any of these other programs on human sexuality, you would call 212-757-4488. It has been an absolute delight, Roberta, once again.
For me too, Armand. It's been really fascinating. And I would like to think of where we're going next in our next series.
My heart is filled with gladness.